All right, so we are we're discussing the very confusing sale of Joseph. I talked about it somewhat last time. I'm going to talk a little bit more about it today, and then we move on to chapter 38, which is an entirely different story, sort of an interpolation in the Joseph story. But first, let's do this. The one other thing, I found one nice comment. I have the habit, of course, of reading over when I look at commentaries. Since there are so many, you can never read all of them before you get to the verses that we study. And so sometimes I find something, a nice commentary on something we've already done. When it says, verse 21, chapter 37, we looked at this last time. And Reuven heard, and he saved. Remember, we talked about the translation of this. It says, Vayatzilehu miyadam. He saved them from their hand, which of course he didn't, right? Because he tried to. And that's how this is translated. It says he tried to save him from them, but he doesn't. Nonetheless, the text says he saved Joseph from their hand. And he said, let us not take his life, shed no blood, and so on. So one rabbi said, what it means by he saved them is when the mob is calling for blood and someone manages to stand up and say, this is wrong, that's already a partial salvation, which I thought was a really nice, I mean, the point is, couldn't have been easy, even with Reuven being the oldest one, for him to be the only one who stood up and said, let's not do this. You know how hard it is, right, to be the lone dissenter. So I thought that was a nice interpretation. All right, now, let's start with the sale of Joseph and try to figure out what happened. Verse 25, they sat down to a meal. Looking up, they saw a caravan of Yishmaelites coming from Gilad. Okay? So Judah suggests in verse 26, why should we kill him and cover up his blood? Let's sell him to the Yishmaelites, but not do away with him ourselves. After all, he's our own brother, our own flesh. Which, again, could be seen cynically or kindly, because to say, let's just sell him is obviously not, you know, not an expression of fraternal feeling. So that his brothers agreed. Then it says, when Midianite traders passed by, they pulled Joseph up out of the pit. In other words, they saw the Ishmaelites, but somehow the Midianites got him. Rashi and most of the commentators following him say that when it says they pulled Joseph up out of the pit, it's talking about the brothers. And that's why we assume that the brothers sold him. That's what Rashi says. Wait, we're not done with this, but that's what he says. In other words, they saw Yishmaelites, but the Midianites came first. They pulled Joseph out of the pit and they sell him to the Midianites. Okay? Then Reuven comes back and doesn't see him because Reuven was elsewhere, wherever Reuven was. This is Rashi's reading so far. But the problem with this, of course, is then it says, the Midianites, look at verse 36. The Midianites, meanwhile, sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, a courtier of Pharaoh and his chief steward. Do you see that? Okay. That seems to be clear. But the problem is that when you go to chapter 39, skip over 38 because it's on a separate subject, just for a second. What does it say? When Joseph was taken down to Egypt, a certain Egyptian Potiphar, a courtier of Pharaoh and his chief steward, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him there. Ah, yes. So now we have a serious problem, which is none of this makes sense. There's clearly a confusion between the Ishmaelites and the Midianites here, and we don't know who Joseph was sold to, which after all is an important, I mean, this is like a pivot of Jewish history, you should know. But it says the Ishmaelites, they saw the Ishmaelites, they sold him to the Midianites sold him to Potiphar, Potiphar bought him from the Ishmaelites. None of it makes sense. So there are several different attempts, as you can imagine, to try to sort out this confusion. The most common attempt, which is done in different ways by Rashi and by Chizkuni. Chizkuni is, this is very Jewish. So Rashi's the most quoted commentator to the Torah. Chizkuni is the premier commentator on Rashi's comment to the Torah, okay? And when I say the premier, he's not the only one. He's just the most common. It's called a super commentary. He explains Rashi's commentary. I don't know who explains Chizkuni's, but, well, actually, Leibovitz brings Chizkuni's, so she explains his. So the most common is to posit sales that aren't recorded. That is, the Midianites sold them to the Ishmaelites, who sold them back to the Midianites. But still you have the problem of the direct contradiction of, in one chapter it says the Midianites sold him, and in the other chapter it says they bought him from the Ishmaelites. So one attempt to answer this is that the, and this is actually very clever, I mean, I don't know that it's true or not true, but it's really very smart, is that Potiphar is, after all, a respectable businessman. He doesn't want to buy kidnapped and sold people. So he says to the Midianites, from whom he bought Joseph, where's your bill of sale? They bring forward the Ishmaelites and say, "These we bought them legitimately from these Ishmaelites." So in fact, Potiphar bought them from both. Smart, come on, give him some credit. It may not be true, but it's very clever. I read last time an attempt to explain it by which the other, and here's the other disputed part, by which the brothers didn't sell him. The other possibility is that the Midianites found him and they pulled Joseph out of the pit. The brothers never sold him, which is why, even though it's commonly assumed that the brothers sold him, but it makes in some ways more sense that the brothers didn't do it. It's why Reuven comes back and is shocked, and the brothers don't say, "Oh, don't, it's okay, we sold him." Because remember, Reuven assumes that he's dead, right? You come back to a pit, he's not there. He assumes that he, and so it also means that when they told their father he was torn by a wild beast, they might believe it. And it also means that when Judah says to the father that he's dead, says later to Joseph, "We had another brother, but he's dead," which is what he says when Joseph asks about the family. In ancient times, as in modern times, but especially then, you don't say about someone he's dead if you don't know that he's dead, because words are too powerful. So for Judah to actually say he's dead is not, you know, it's not kosher in a way, unless he really assumed that Joseph was dead. And also Joseph himself, who after all we don't assume goes around lying, doesn't say to Pharaoh, "I was sold from the land of the Hebrews." He said, "I was stolen from the land of the Hebrews." So all of this means that you could make a really good case that the Midianites actually took Joseph and sold him, and his brothers never did. Which, if you want to be generous towards the brothers, means if you had given them more time and more deliberation, maybe they would have decided not to sell him, who knows? And the thing about, I mentioned this before, but it's worth repeating. When I talk about how powerful words are, they're so powerful in the ancient world that if you're saying something bad, you use what's called Lashon Sagi Nahor, the language of sufficient light. You say the opposite. The reason it's called the language of sufficient light is that's how in Talmudic times you referred to someone who was blind. You didn't say they were blind. You said the exact opposite. They're of sufficient light. So sometimes, for example, in the commentaries, when the commentator wants to say, if this happens, Israel will be destroyed, they'll write, if this happens, Israel's enemies will be destroyed. Because they don't actually even want to write, Israel will be destroyed. And you, as the reader, have to know that that's Lashon Sagi Nahor, right? Which means that's why oaths are so powerful in the Bible. And why do you have Kol Nidre? You have Kol Nidre because words are so serious that they have to be absolved by this big public ceremony in which you say, okay, if I made an oath that I couldn't fulfill, you know, forgive me. So for Judah to say Joseph is dead if he doesn't know he's dead is, you know, did you read that case? Lahavdil, right, which means it's different, but still. Did you read the case of the woman who was snatched as a baby in New York and now she's 23 years old and she just found her parents? So one of the things that the parents said, of course, was we never accepted her death because we didn't know whether she was alive or dead. And if we didn't know, we always assumed she was alive, right? Which is exactly what you would expect. And yet, weirdly, as you'll see, when the brothers come to Jacob and say Joseph is dead, he accepts it right away. Which would be much more plausible if they believed it, right? If they really thought, I mean, granted, they bring him a bloody coat. But, you know, a bloody coat just means that there's blood on a coat or that he was injured or whatever. It doesn't necessarily mean he's dead. But if the brothers all believe he's dead, that's a much more persuasive presentation, okay? And if they all had sold him into slavery, it's hard enough for one person to lie convincingly. To get like 10 people, all of them to lie convincingly to their father, who really wants to believe the opposite, the best way to do that is to, for them to believe it. So you could make the case that the brothers didn't sell him into slavery and they really believed he was dead. And also, as I said last time, that's why they don't recognize Joseph when they see him. Because if you think someone's dead, then even so big deal, the viceroy of Egypt vaguely resembles their dead brother. Because he's older and he has a beard and presumably speaks Egyptian. Okay, so having said all of that, none of it is actually the best explanation for the sale that I've read. The best explanation for the confusing sale comes from a modern Bible scholar, Ed Greenstein, who used to teach at the Jewish Theological Seminary and now teaches at either Bar-Ilan or Hebrew University, I don't remember, in Israel. And he wrote an article years ago about the sale of Joseph, where he goes through all the possibilities and shows, although we don't need to show because we already know, that none of them really work, right? It doesn't matter how, you have to assume all sorts of things that if you were writing the Bible, and you have to assume, obviously, well, let me back up for 1 second. Modern scholars think that there were two different strands of the sale of Joseph, right? They think that this was combined, that there was one story that said that Joseph was sold by the Ishmaelites and one story that Joseph was sold by the Midianites, and this story combines both traditions. But Greenstein says, even if that's true, anybody who combines both traditions has got to see that this is that it doesn't work. All he had to do was like include one more sale of one to the other or the other. So why did they make the story so deliberately confusing? And his answer is, it's to let you know that Joseph was going to get to Egypt because it was God's design. And the fact that you can't figure it out is supposed to signal to you that it isn't human agency that brings Joseph to Egypt. The whole point is God had to get Joseph to Egypt, and if the Bible made it too intelligible, that is, if you could understand exactly how he got there, you might think, oh, well, it was a terrible event, but it was a perfectly normal event. And the Torah wants you to know it wasn't a perfectly normal event. It was clearly done by God, and that's why you're supposed to be confused and not understand how Joseph got to Egypt, which I thought was a beautiful answer and makes a lot of sense because, as you saw, it's impossible to read this and not see that it doesn't make sense, right? It's obvious that it doesn't make sense. So if it's obvious to us reading it once, it's clearly obvious to whoever wrote it, right? Whether God or human beings, it's clearly confusing, and that's a good reason why it is. Okay, so there's the sale. Let's now come to the terrible moment, which we will review again next time, but let's at least take a preliminary look at it. Okay. When Reuven, verse 29 now, when Reuven returned to the pit and saw that Joseph wasn't in the pit, he rent his clothes. We talked about that as a sign of mourning and still is, which is another reason, by the way, to assume that Reuven thought he was dead. You don't rent your clothes for someone who's sold, right? You tear your clothes for someone who's dead. So that's what Reuven probably assumed, although I don't know why you would assume that if he was just gone, unless, as we said last time, the only reason to be gone from the pit if he's not with the brothers is because he was taken by a wild animal. But I still would like someone to address the question that somebody asked last time, which is, if the pit was deep enough for Joseph not to be able to climb out, how does a wild animal get in there and kill him and drag him out? And I don't know the answer to that. What? Yeah, with a fishing pole, exactly. I don't know. I don't know, but I also don't know like what the status of poles and animals was in ancient Israel. So, you know, I don't know. Reuven knew better than I did, and he rent his clothes. So you got to figure that it must happen sometimes. Anyway, returning to his brothers, he said, "The boy is gone. Now what am I to do?" And gone, of course, is an ambiguous enenu, but enenu means, could easily mean, doesn't exist. That is, that he's dead, right? So now what am I to do? It's also interesting that he says, not what are we to do. But he says, what am I to do? Because he's the oldest, and the oldest takes responsibility. And, you know, when I was a little kid, I remember which house I was in Harrisburg. It's good when you can divide your childhood up. You don't remember how old you were, but if you know which house, you know. So I left this house when I was six. So I was six or under, which means my brother was eight or under. And we were playing in the front yard, and a car actually came up on the front yard. Didn't hit us, but a car came up on the front yard, and my parents came rushing out. And I don't remember this, but my parents have since told me, my older brother looked up and said, I didn't do it. You know, because he was playing with his younger brother and he was responsible. So he wanted my parents to know, right, he didn't do it, which explanation they accepted, apparently. But that's that. Yeah, no, exactly. Right. So Reuven assumes something terrible happened. His father's going to turn to him, right, and say, you're the oldest. What happened? Which also tells you, I mean, remember that the oldest had even more weight and responsibility in the ancient world. So now what am I to do? Then they took Joseph's tunic, slaughtered a kid, which is, of course, very, you know, symbolic, and they dipped the tunic, this is the coat of many colors or whatever you want to call it, they dipped the tunic in blood. And again, there's a lot of resonance here. You know, we take this for granted, but really this is an artfully put together story. It was, after all, the tunic that spurred their jealousy, and now they're dipping it in blood to prove that he's dead. And it's very powerfully symbolic of how they feel about him, and now they're trying to exonerate, like Joseph is a sacrifice, right? And they actually do sacrifice something to pretend that Joseph is a sacrifice. They had the ornamented tunic taken to their father, right? Which means that they didn't take it. It says, Vayishalchu et ketonet hapasim. They first had it sent to him before they came. Why did they send it to him before they came? Because that way he can have his immediate reaction not in their presence. And then they can come and do it. This is, again, to revert to a completely irrelevant, but tangentially relevant. I remember when I was diagnosed with lymphoma, and I talked to the doctor, and we were talking about how do you tell the congregation that you have cancer? What's the right way? And I said to him, it was Steve Foreman at City of Hope, I should give him credit. And I said to him, I think I'll just get up and, you know, it was close to the high holidays. I said, the high holidays, and I'll tell everyone. And he said, don't do that. I said, why? He said, because everybody will have reactions and they won't know what their reaction is right away, and you'll be right in front of them. And it's not fair to do to them to make them react instantly. He said, send out a letter, let people react the way they react, and then they can compose themselves and see you and react the way they want to react as opposed to being stunned. He was exactly right. It was very wise. And that's exactly what the brothers are doing, right? They're allowing their father to react so that by the time they see him, it's manageable, right? Yeah.
Why didn't the brother say to Judah, don't worry, we sold him?
Because they didn't, unless they didn't. Unless they didn't sell him to Reuven, right? Unless the Midianites pulled him up, and they're as surprised as he is. That's one piece of evidence also in favor of that idea. I mean, the other possibility is, of course, that they don't want Reuven to know that they did it, because Reuven didn't want them to, and they'd rather have Reuven be a fall guy than tell them what he did, because sometimes confessing to an older brother, especially if the older brother has this much authority, is like confessing to your father. So they had it taken to the father, and they said, and then they come, clearly, and they said, we found this. Please examine it. Is it your son's tunic or not? Right? So they let him draw the conclusion rather than saying to him, Joseph is dead. And his conclusion is over the top. It really is. Look at what he immediately says. He recognizes, says, my son's tunic, a savage beast devoured him. Joseph was torn by a beast. Now that's not the reaction you would get, and we'll talk more about this next time, because Robert Alter, whose stuff I'll bring next time, has a very powerful comment on this. But right after that, he rent his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and observed mourning for his son many days. He has no question that this happened, which is, I mean, the brothers don't even have to persuade him. He just automatically sees the coat and jumps to the conclusion that Joseph is dead, that he was killed. Now, partly, one assumes, he lives in a world in which this kind of thing happens. And if you find a bloody coat, you know, there were beasts all around the ancient world. It was not like today. There are stories all the time about in the time of the Talmud too, which is already 1,500 years later, 1,000 years later, depending on which part of the Torah and which part of the Talmud, there are still wild beasts that roam around. You know, Rabbi Akiva, there is a famous story about Rabbi Akiva looking at jackals walking over the ruins of the temple. I mean, it wasn't like today. So the idea that people got devoured by beasts was probably not so uncommon. And when he sees that, that's the natural assumption. On the other hand, you got to also wonder why he doesn't say, oh my God, Joseph might be out there injured somewhere or hurt or where did you find this? And let's go see if we can recover his body or anything. And at least one possible theory is that this is guilt. Because remember, Jacob sent him to the brothers in the first place, even though he knew that the brothers resented him. He knew that because it took note of his dreams, and still he sent them. So maybe it's even, and this is going far, and I'll actually close with this and make a comment on it, and then we'll talk. Maybe it's even a little bit of horrified wish fulfillment. And I say that because the Bible, there was a book by a guy named Eric Welish, who was a psychiatrist, called The Isaac Complex. And he said, if Freud had spent less time with Greek myth and more time with the Bible, he would have seen that it's not only true that children want to destroy their parents, but it's true that parents want to destroy their children. He said, that's what the story of Abraham is about, right? He said, that's what the story of Saul and David is about. Saul, David is a sort of adopted child to Saul. Judith Viorst, who wrote the book Necessary Losses, she writes about this, that in psychiatry you discover that children constrain their parents' lives all the time in all sorts of ways. And you will never get a parent, or rarely get a parent, to say out loud, yes, I hate my child. But it's very rare for a parent not sometimes to feel that. Because how can you not feel that about somebody who completely constrains and changes your life? And is so ungrateful, too. So, not my child, but other kids. And that idea, the idea that parents sometimes destroy their children deliberately, inadvertently, in all sorts of ways, is a theme that runs through the Bible much more than the theme of children seeking to destroy their parents, which is what Freud said about the Oedipal complex, and people had just as hard a time, right? How could you think that children ever want to destroy their parents? Of course, don't children love their parents? And the answer is yes, except when they hate them. And the same thing is true of parents, but we don't like to say it, especially because children can't hear it, right? Children don't want to hear that sometimes your parents hate you. But if that's so, and Isaac feels that about Joseph, who's also the child that he most loves, so that means it goes, I mean Jacob, it has that it goes very deep, then maybe this is also his recognition that some part of him wanted Joseph to get his comeuppance from the brothers. Not that he wanted him to be killed, but he wanted them to, like, you know, take him down a peg, and this was the result of it. I don't know that that's true, but Yiftach, by the way, is another example in the Bible. Remember, Yiftach kills his daughter. If you don't remember that, trust me on this. Yiftach is one of the judges. He makes an oath to God that the first thing that comes out of his house after he comes back from battle, if he wins the battle, he will sacrifice, and the first thing that comes out is his daughter. So the Torah really has that theme through it. I mean, it begins obviously with Abraham and Isaac, but the Torah has that theme in it of and here I just want to say, as hard as it is to hear, I think that it's an enormous credit to the Torah that it doesn't hide even the deepest and the darkest human passions. Parents, children, children, parents, siblings, husbands, wives, all of it gets played out in the Torah because all of it gets played out in human life. And it's not true for everyone all the time, obviously, but it's true enough that it can, right, that you can understand that this actually might be part of what Jacob was feeling. So, okay, let's stop there and take questions or comments. Yeah, go ahead. Right. I don't know. That's what I was just trying to answer. That's my best answer, though. Yeah.
I think perhaps the confusion can be explained away by saying that the Midianites and the Ishmaelites were the same.
Were the same. Well, someone said that they were two names for the same tribe. That has been proposed. The problem with that, of course, is then why are they sometimes called Midianites and why are they sometimes called Ishmaelites, and why elsewhere in the Torah are they identified clearly as two different people? But that is one attempt to try to... that one is a subgroup of a larger group, you know. Yeah. Go ahead.
Is there never any question that the brothers said the cult be somebody else because of their own sense of guilt and maybe
of their own what?
Sense of guilt and shame?
No, sure. It's certainly very possible that they don't send it because it's just so hard for them to face up to what they've done, which you clearly see later. That they're not the same brothers in front of Joseph as they were before. So, yeah. Marcy? Why did they dip it in blood? To show their father that he's dead.
Why?
Because if they just come home and say, Joseph is dead, he's going to say, how do you know? Where was he? How did you, I mean, then they have to say, well, he was in the pit, you know. That kind of thing. It's like the joke about the guy who's taking care of someone else's cat when he's on vacation, and he says, and the guy calls him and he says, so how's the cat doing? He goes, the cat's dead. He says, what? He says, you don't just say the cat's dead. He says, you got to ease me into it. You say that your cat was on the roof and he fell and he hurt himself and I took him to the hospital and they tried to revive him, but unfortunately he died. He says, I'm really sorry. He goes, how's mom? He says, mom's on the roof. So, yeah. Why is there so much strife between parents and children and so little strife between spouses? It certainly is more between parents and children, although with Abraham and Sarah, there's clearly something, right? Twice he passes her off as a sister, and there is even an argument recorded about whether she can have a child or not. There is Rachel gets angry at Jacob for not, because she can't have a child, and she says, why didn't you pray for me? And I'm sorry, that's Rebecca and Isaac. And I'm trying to think where else. Moses and Zipporah, it doesn't record it, but they clearly have a strained relationship. So I don't know. It's an interesting, or not, or they have no relationship, or little relationship. I don't know, it's an interesting question, but there is more about siblings, no question about it. Yeah. That could be. That's a more generous reading, and also very plausible that the reason he assumes this is because it's his deepest fear. And you always somehow, somewhere inside you think your deepest fear is going to come to be. So when it happens, you're right. You just go with it, and you're unsurprised. Yeah.
My question is that when the brother wanted to write the brother,
it's a good point, that if they didn't think he was dead, how is it that they wouldn't, why wouldn't they assume that somehow he'd find his way back home? If they knew that the Midianites had sold him, I guess it's possible that they, on the one hand, if you're sold as a slave, it's very hard in the ancient world to ever, ever escape that. So it's possible, well, I'm saying, so one possibility is that they knew he was sold as a slave and they thought that's it for him. Another possibility is that they really thought he was dead, so they thought he would never come home. It does sort of reinforce it. a little bit the idea that they really did think he was dead. Yeah. Yeah, that's what the traditional commentary is, that Isaac knew with the power of nevuah, of prophecy, that with the power of prophecy, before he died, he knew that Joseph was alive, because Isaac hasn't died yet. That's Joseph's grandfather, right, Jacob's father. But this prophecy is associated with Isaac in part because of the dimming of his vision, right? But we don't hear anything in the Torah about it. It's a rabbinic tradition.
So. There's nothing that surrounds it.
Not that I'm aware of. No, I don't know where it came from, but it's in the Midrash. I don't know what textual trigger set it off. I'll try to find out. Yeah. Right. Fair point. Torn by a beast in the ancient world, you were a goner. Right. That's also probably true, is that it may be that I'm reflecting a modern mentality. You know, I don't know why they didn't, like, medevac Joseph to Babylonian general. But all I can say is, if they'd taken him to Seattle Grace, he could have been saved. By the Grey's Anatomy crew, Shepherd would have gotten in. It would have been fine, but alas, yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
You see, we're setting this to you because
right.
This is what happened. Here's proof, and then he did. Okay, you're right.
It is certainly, yeah, it's certainly possible that you're right, that something is missing in there. But there are so, right, it's a very contentious and difficult issue to try to figure out where something isn't. But yeah, it does feel like there's a lot of cross cutting in this story. Yep. Or we don't have the whole story. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you something else, but that question just nails me. It says in 25, they sat down to a meal.
Mm-hmm.
Looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, their camels bearing gum,
right.
Balm, and lantanum. How'd they know that?
It doesn't say that they knew that their camels were bearing it. It just says they saw it, and that's what the Ishmaelites' caravan was bearing, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they could identify it. Of course, I said last time, the rabbis say that the reason that they had all these spices was so that Joseph's trip to Egypt would be more pleasant. That God arranged that, you know? Maybe there were distinctive holders for all those different spices, and they knew, you know, that kind of sack holds this and that kind holds that. In the same way that you could see a Brinks truck and say to a kid, there's money in that truck, and they would say, how do you know that?
Might not there have been scouts sent out ahead of the caravan?
Conceivably. Maybe there were scouts. It's possible.
And the story then, it can fill in the blanks.
Yeah, it's possible.
Like the nameless guy who said, go here, go here.
Right, the Ish Dotan, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Hold, anybody who hasn't yet, yeah, go ahead.
It says all of his sons and daughters. Did Jacob have just Dina, or is it talking about...
As far as we know, just Dina, but... conceivable someone else, although I don't remember ever a mention of anyone else offhand. So, yeah.
Why are they sacrificing a kid and not an animal?
No, a kid is an animal.
Oh.
A kid is a baby, right. Yes. I can't hear you.
Is it relevant that the messenger who carries the code to Jacob not identified?
Messengers almost never are. So, my guess is that the brothers, being wealthy, had, you know, servant boys around them, in the same way that Abraham, when he saddles up the ass and goes to the mountain, also leaves the servant boy. I mean, the tradition identifies him with Ishmael, but whoever he was, leaves the servant boy down there with the donkey. Yeah.
Okay.
and then one more after this, and then again.
Rents his clothes, puts on sackcloth, goes away to mourn. When did the customs of mourning come into being?
The customs of mourning are already mentioned in the Bible. I mean, Job's friends sit on, wear sackcloth and rent their clothes and weep. So, I mean, they developed tremendously, but the idea of renting your clothes, putting sackcloth and ashes on, that already is in the Torah. Yeah. Last question. Well, that's the assumption, right? The assumption of the rabbis is that the brothers knew that he was sold because they follow, I mean, Rashi is almost always following the rabbinic tradition. The rabbis assume the brothers sold him and then fool their father in the same way that Jacob fooled his father, right? That it's coming back. This was one of the parallels between Isaac's life, between Jacob's life and Joseph's life. Joseph is taken away from his father as a result of a deception. Joseph, I don't know which one I just said. Joseph and Jacob are both taken away from their fathers as a result of a deception and spend their formative years elsewhere because, although Joseph doesn't perpetrate the deception and Jacob does, Jacob's getting payback for what he did. Okay, so next week, chapter 38, which is a completely different story, the story of Judah and Tamar, and why it's stuck in the middle of the Joseph story. Thanks very much. Sorry I got to run.